So just so you know, since there's so many women here, I just walked the women's bathroom open.
Oh.
So you need to be happy about the code. For the men, you have to look at the code.
You're gonna have to figure it out.
I'm like trying to be like, la la, I don't see that.
Three of you guys is.
All right, let's open up with.
The door is not open, that's true.
It's okay, let's all get it out. Let's open it up to introductions first, and let's start from right here.
So I'm the problem person walking open the bathroom doors, but I'm Maria Wolf. I work with the city, and I am a homeless innovations officer for the city. I've been with you guys for 3 months now, so.
I'm Wendy Barron, and that's all, but I don't do anything. I'm a neighbor, a concerned citizen, just interested in knowing what's going on.
That's doing things, ma'am.
Donna Strong, and I'm just Parkland Hills for a long time. Long enough to see it go from good to not so good.
Wally Book, Parkland Hills, also.
Dee Ivy, I live in District 6, up the road in Knoxville.
And it's your first time here joining us, welcome.
I know, yeah, I'm looking forward to learning about the updates and what's going on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Kathleen O'Malley, and I'm very interested in the different neighborhoods in the community and how people are handling different neighborhood issues, so eager to learn from you all what you're doing here.
Thank you, and it's your first time too, so welcome.
Thanks, thanks.
Yeah, I'm here at Watson, Parkland Hills, and I'm the one who gave Kathleen the information to come because she wanted to be invited, and she brought along Dee.
Thank you.
And I'm Parkland Hills, and I've been in the neighborhood 35 years, and I've been to these meetings before.
Thank you.
Kristen Green, go by Raven, and I am a candidate for District 6 City Council and Elder Homestead Neighborhood Association elected board member, Homelessness Solutions Chair, and Neighborhood Beautification Coordinator.
Sandra Perea, Vice President for the District 6 Neighborhood Coalition and President for Elder Homestead.
Thank you.
I'm Rachel Baca. I'm the Siesta Hills Gateway Chair. I was the president for quite a few years there, but now I've just shifted into the Gateway Chair position.
Awesome.
Good evening, Pete Paletto, D6.
Thank you.
Good evening, my name is Rachel Mendez. I'm with the City of Albuquerque. This is my first week officially as the Homeless Public Outreach Volunteer Coordinator. Nice to meet you all. I'll just see you all.
This isn't the last time.
Mike Wachowski, this month marked 11 years engagement, direct engagement on the streets with homeless folks. I interact with them at 2:30 in the morning, out in the middle of nowhere.
Your work. Carol Pierce, I'm the Director of Health, Housing, and Homelessness with the City of Albuquerque.
And I'm Devin Mandel Kloster. I'm the Acting Division Manager for the Health. Homeless Programs and Initiatives Division. I'll be presenting.
Could you repeat your title, please?
Sure. I'm the Acting Division Manager.
And it's Homeless Programs and
Initiatives Division.
I think y'all can make it a little longer.
I know. We rebranded to more. Housing, homelessness, it's just a...
It's Rachel's title. We're really struggling.
Yeah.
Hers is very long.
Yeah.
And do either of you have business cards with you?
I do.
Not yet. They haven't been ordered.
These are the old ones.
I'll give you one of mine and you can write yourself.
And we can actually write Rachel's email up here for all of you guys. So that, do you want to come up and write it up? Because that way you'll know how to get a hold of her. Do you want us to sit at the table? John, we just did introductions if you want to introduce yourself. And Jeff, we skipped you. How did we skip you?
I'm sneaky back here.
You were
I'll quickly go through mine. I will disappoint you. My title is not much shorter. Jeffrey Bustamante, Deputy Director of Violence Prevention and Intervention for Albuquerque Community Safety. Excited to be here again. Not my first time, but coming up on my first year with this city. So almost hit my one-year anniversary.
Dr. Aska Naru, very simple title, Gateway Manager. While met before, I see new faces today. So for you, I'm going to go into a little bit of my background. I'm a pharmacist by training. I got my master's in public health from UNM. I've been here in New Mexico for 10 years now. Before this, I was working with the state human services department as one of their emergency managers during COVID medical sheltering and the wildfires. And that was all the work that we did in congregate, non-congregate sheltering that was relevant to what I'm doing today. So that's how I got picked for this, and I'm here in front of you. All right, let's begin. We're settled in. Next, we are going to review our meeting purposes and intended results. This is a platform open to all members of the community action area with the goal to build consensus on the issues that neighbors want to address and to develop action plans by mapping assets in the community. Serves as an opportunity to ensure an equitable representation of voices from neighborhoods surrounding the Gibson Health Hub. Together, we will establish community guidelines and identify boundaries for the purpose of ensuring respect and courtesy, prioritizing productive ideas and communication to identify root causes of poverty, crime, and violence in the community. Our goal is to find a balance between moving our conversations forward in identifying greater solutions and intentions while still addressing concerns in real time. What are we intending for this meeting? As our results and outcomes, we are going to go over updates from Gateway and overall Gibson Health Hub, which is this center. We're going to learn about housing vouchers today. That's why we have Devin joining us. Then we're going to go into community building, and I'm going to bring in and distribute books that we ordered the last time that we were interested in. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the Good Neighbors Agreement and plans for next day of our meeting. Okay, let's begin with updates on Gateway programming. So I always open up with census. We're at 46 out of the 50 total beds that we have at the Gateway Center. And then again, like new people joining. So let's go from the beginning of how we're set up. So the Gateway Center here, it has opened 50 beds available to ladies, women, women who identify, individuals who identify as women. Who have access to this housing navigation facility is what we call it. And the reason we call it that and not a shelter is because this is a program with a length of stay of total of 90 days where they're living with us. And this is a low-barrier, trauma-informed facility where we are assessing the needs of our clients with our case managers very closely to identify what resources that we can connect them with within the same facility. So imagine a client who has to go get connected to workforce solutions for career readiness or open and connected to opportunities for jobs. So instead of figuring out, you know, what best bus to get on, how to get there, get on a wait list, get an appointment, we bring those resources on site is what the model is. So they, out of all of the time that they have to figure out logistics, they can sit down with their case manager and figure out stability towards their life. So that's the model that we're using. And we have a referral process for this. So this is referrals only. Our service providers have access to our Gateway referral link. There is an assessment that happens with our intake coordinators here with Heading Home, who are our operators for this facility. And then they get referred into the Gateway program. The central piece of this, like I said,
getting resources on site. We call it the Engagement Center. With the Engagement Center, we are basically supporting that housing model for successful outcomes. When you're housing, you need to be able to ensure that they also have the tools that they need to succeed and that they're not going to fall through the cracks. So to be able to connect them with those resources in this one site, we are basically in the works of beefing up the Engagement Center. From the last time I met you all, we have signed an MOU with Goodwill. So Goodwill is also on board, and it's the main thing to make very excited about this is working with career readiness and opportunities for jobs, so job-related training that they are going to be providing on site. So we're very excited to onboard them and just look at, you know, the effects that's going to have on the outcomes that we're anticipating. So that's the update I have on that. And then the next piece of this within the Gateway programming is that we are also opening up for emergency wind events. These are going to be meal only and a total of 35 beds that are going to be available on the facility. And these are also referrals only. So again, same service providers, access to link, refer in, intake coordination, triage, and then get them to the beds.
So the 35 beds are in addition to the 50?
In addition to the 50, yes, ma'am. So these are overall my updates on Gateway programming. Next, we're going to go overall into the Gibson facility. Medical sobering and medical respite pieces.
One quick question. Will the 35 winter beds be women only, or will they be all?
They're male only.
Trying to bring some balance.
Sorry.
I thought she said M-A-I-L.
Oh. I thought you were talking about male.
Men.
I also do
men
recognize
will be in the winter shelter.
Yes. Yes.
Those who identify as men.
Those who identify as that. Thank you for that. Yeah. Yes. And I also do recognize that I have a different accent. So. All right. Gibson world. Medical sobering, medical respite. You know, sobering for the outcome of serving 17,000 people per year. Medical respite, 320 people per year. Construction is underway, and we are aiming to go live on that by next year, fall. The Family Housing Navigation Center model is still being used, up and operational. We have housed 1,100 people successfully, and you know, connecting services on site like we do here at the Gateway Center to be able to make sure that with housing, they also have the support to sustain housing. So that's been happening, and then we have...
But just to be clear, the Family Housing Navigation Center is not here.
It's not here.
It's
so is that the 1,100? Huh? Is that the 1,100?
That's
yeah.
1,100.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we should say the reason we like to update you all on that is because it's a piece of the system. I mean, we could go probably on and on and on because there's so many other community providers doing good work. But that's a piece of it because we won't have families here. And we made that decision logistically. It's just a different piece. So that's why we've operated that since actually the end of October. That's why those numbers look good. That model and the model here is built off of family.
So the 1,100 are like children and adults?
Yes, yes. And we have that breakdown. We could always dive in. And if that in the future is one of the topics, like tonight we're having housing vouchers, you asked for medical sobering, we're going to be doing that on our next meeting. But if you wanted to hear more about that, we could bring the experts here and dive in on that to learn more about that.
Are those individuals housed around the city?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'll get into more of that.
We're really going to dive into that.
Yeah.
All right. Next update I have for you is the emergency bed tracker, which is going live next week for our first responders. we are asking all partners to work with us and keeping as up to date as possible on that database. So what it's going to do basically is show our providers how many beds are available throughout the city for emergency sheltering. And we're working very hard, very closely with the Emergency Operations Center here in Albuquerque to be able to successfully make that work.
When do you anticipate that being up and going?
So next week we're going live with that.
Oh, yes.
So well, we actually did a
been using it now.
Yeah, we did a soft launch with the city shelters first because we can like say you have to update this every single night. And then we've been working with contacts to all of our other partner agencies that also have shelters to try to get them to like see the value of updating it every night. And so the goal is so that an ACS responder or a police officer can go into this app that they have access to and see that, okay, this person has actually agreed to go to shelter, and I can look and see, oh, there's a shelter here, there's a bed here, there's a bed here, and then they can arrange transportation for the individual. That's the goal.
So it's like a 24/7 thing because it's an app?
That's exactly, and the shelters have access to update it themselves, and we have different update times depending on the shelter. Some require everybody to be in by 6 p.m. Now the Westside Shelter has an 8 o'clock bus, so they'll be updating it after that bus goes in. So it just depends on the location when they're updating it, but the officers will hopefully have the most up-to-date information, or the ACS responders will have the most up-to-date information.
So it's ACS, APD, and your other providers that you partner with?
And AFR. It's
and
really firefighter. A first responder portal for them to be able to take people.
Thank you.
Next, we have updates on our receiving area. So I'm just going to dive into this a little bit. Part of the Gateway Center, an area designated for our first responders to be able to drop off individuals in need, especially after hours. There is a waiting area, and we have overnight triage rooms with pull-out beds to be able to keep, for example, we have a family coming in, they have the privacy to be able to stay there overnight, while our receiving area operators are able to figure out through that triage and intake mechanism to look at the best place to situate them. This, we're working right now with our partners. Our conversations for an emergency procurement are happening with UNM until we get to a point where we push out an RFP to bid. So that's also the piece that we're making progress on really quickly trying to get there because we want to open up our receiving area soon.
So you just said families.
Yeah.
And then you said no families can stay here. So they just come here to be triaged or something?
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's cruel. And you take them away?
So it's not, this is a temporary space where they can come safely. Mm-hmm. You know, officers, like I worked with an officer once, midnight at the transit center downtown, finds a father with a child. Only two shelters accept men with children, and that's Joy Junction and the Family Navigation Center. This family had been removed from those places previously, so it wasn't an option to take them back. So then what's the officer to do? Like, you don't, like, take them to jail. Where do you take them? Well, now you'll be able to take them here, because this is a place that'll work for families, individuals, couples, until the next day when we can figure out the best spot for them.
So they do actually stay the night.
They can stay the night, they can stay the day. They if they come during the day, they'll probably be placed before the end of the day.
Right.
If they come in the night, it may be before the end of the next day.
And maybe I missed this, you might have said, how long can people stay?
So it's a 90-day program, which does not go to say that at the end of 90 days you're gonna have to exit. Sorry, do you have something?
For the receiving area.
Oh, you mean for the receiving area or for the gateway? You're asking the total length of stay.
Oh.
So there are two
different
parts. It's two different program spaces. One is for the women, and it's 90 days with wraparound services. The receiving area is a space where first responders can bring a person or a family or a couple who
need help right then and need a place to go to be safe. They do have the ability to stay overnight, and you know, our team is going to work very closely with them to be able to navigate to where they need to go next. But if they need to stay overnight, like I said, we have those private rooms, and then we have the waiting area.
And then can they go through the other process to stay longer?
Yeah. They get placed into Gateway? Yes, absolutely.
Was the abandoned child, was that a hypothetical, or is that somebody that was...
No, that's a real situation.
If they've been removed from someplace twice and then come here, will they have a particular eye on them, like, to figure out, like, are they going to be good in the area? I'm just curious about people that have been removed and no longer able to access shelter and then coming here.
So, you know, some people, like, they have behavior issues. This man was a strong advocate for what his child needed, and people didn't appreciate his advocacy style. So that doesn't necessarily mean he was a bad dad, but it meant that he needed some education on anger management and conflict resolution. And so he, since then, has had access to those and hopefully is on a more stable basis. But at that point, he had burned bridges in the two shelters that allowed him as a father, and was living out of a car. The car was towed because it was parked somewhere where it wasn't supposed to be. And they lost everything and ended up with a transit center. So then what do you do? So in that situation, what happened is the officer paid for two nights at a hotel. And then we worked with a number of charitable organizations, and we worked on, you know, what are the issues here? What's going on? Is this a father-child that is well-bonded? It's a healthy relationship? Can he provide the care? Okay, then what's next? What's next? What housing options are available? What help is available? And they're stable now. So, like, that was a happy ending. But that was because that officer, like, was there and actually had the wherewithal to go, you know, I'm getting paid 2 hours overtime while I try to figure out where to take you, and that overtime pays for two nights at a hotel, so let's just do this. And then, you know, we got him in good hands along with partners at Family Community who helped get it all figured out. So this will make it a lot easier because the officer wouldn't have to pay for the hotel.
What do you mean by stable? Are they in a home?
They're in a home.
They're in a home.
The child is in school. The dad is getting job training. Okay. Wally.
So essentially the goal here is for Gateway to be a gateway, a hub, a processing center to find a place where these people belong as well. You're not trying to house it all here at any given time.
Yeah.
And that's not the goal.
Yes. It's a pass-through home.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. You're absolutely right. Right. a place to be safe and peaceful, yeah. To be then ready to go to the next place where they'll be able to stay.
And to determine what that place is.
Right. Yes.
Right.
With all the current refugees that are being dropped into our cities, a lot of them in this area, is their placement like with Homeland Security, and they go, or are they part of this, our regular homeless?
I would like for you to chime into, Maria, and I can also talk with my experience working with the state. You know, that Homeland Security placement that you're talking about, yes, whenever we would open up to hire the influx of asylum seekers and refugees coming into the state, that's an emergency that gets activated at the EOC at the state level. So that's where you're working with the Homeland Security Emergency Management Department. And then Homeland Security coordinates with basically all counties at that point, going into a system of care that delves into the cities as well, to be able to access and look at what placement for the families, especially that do come in. And one of the partners that we worked with very closely when we had a higher influx was Lutheran Family Services for the resettlement program that they have. Here are low barrier trauma informed. We have a lady who's here, and she does not have citizenship. She's helpless, right? She's in a vulnerable position. You know, goes through our intake referral system like any other person, and we do take them in.
So, and just so you know, like the influx that we're seeing, FEMA does fund some refugee places for them to sleep and be until they do get transferred to the whoever's sponsoring them. Okay. And so there's usually just a short time period that they're here until they travel to their new location. If they are here for a longer period, because they also have to determine, are they eligible for the asylum, or is this more of an immigration? I mean, there's all of these different determinations that go into it, and then from there, they you know, enter it. It's just a variety of,
okay,
of decisions. And the Office of Equity and Inclusion actually covers a lot of that, and then we overlap on the shelter side of things. But if, again, we're like, if you guys decide you want more details on that, we can ask OEI to come in and talk to you about the refugee and asylum seeker process and the supports that we're developing here and how that works. So do you guys want that, or you want to wait? You can let us know later what you decide.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
I mean, I want to see that.
And that's what we're going to go into next. I'm also going to leave you with, if you want to look into the Emergency Refugee Assistance Program, ERAP, that is at the center of this assistance, so it might help to look into it.
This is Matt. This may be old news. In an interview in August, Carol and Mayor Keller were interviewed here, and one of the statements that they are quoted as having made is that the city is aiming for the center to eventually provide services for 1,000 people a day. Yeah. Is that really going to be
I heard it too
doable?
1,000 a day?
I mean, that statement's made because what we're talking here is Gateway, and when we make that statement, it's including all of our tenants. So right now, when you look at behavioral, the Haven Behavioral Health and our 3 accredited hospitals, we have an estimated, I think it's 200, I mean, it changes, it fluctuates, 200, 250 people overnight already. These are housed people. These are people in accredited hospitals that are here. So there's a total of 9 tenants. And we don't dive into all that because what we're really focused on, Gateway, and if you don't mind, I'm really glad you brought this and we should have brought more. So what we keep talking about are the 5 components. On Gateway, the receiving, medical, sobering, et cetera. But even the women that are here now, when you look at our 90-day model, that's 200 people that we'll be seeing over a year. So back in the heyday when Gibson or Loveless Medical Center, it was about those numbers. So that's our estimate when you look at the tenants, more tenants that will be coming, and when Gateway is fully built out. So we're not there now, but that's taking the whole of Gibson Health up.
So the goal is 1,000 people a day.
Well, the goal is to have this facility fully utilized with tenants and then the Gateway portion as well.
Yeah. It's a lot of traffic. Thank you.
Go ahead, Vera.
He's got one.
Would it be worth touching on, or maybe at another meeting, have a presentation on the coordinated resources guide? Because what I'm hearing is there are a lot of places you can reach out for help, and the work that I've done with the Coalition to End Homelessness, they deal with just 5 programs, and I looked at the website for a coordinated resources guide, and there were 55 or more programs that are available. So there are a lot of resources out there, but you at least have to know that they exist and then have an entry point. And so what you're doing in part is providing that entry point. Is that something that you think would be worth?
I think we like to be driven by you guys. And so if you guys want a presentation on all the resources that are in the resource guide, we can definitely pull it up, show you how you can access it. have the person who does that guide tell you how she obtains the information. So, you know what, let me do, we've talked about a couple of things so far, and I didn't write them down, I'm sorry guys. So, one was the resource guide. What was the thing we talked about a few minutes ago? Does anybody remember?
About the refugees.
Yeah. Bed tracker.
Yeah, ERAP.
And family and children places.
Winter beds. Navigation. Oh my gosh, you're speaking so fast.
Well,
I'm writing so slow.
I think the big one was the family navigation. Housing navigation center.
It's diving into the data.
Yeah.
Okay.
So while she's writing, can I ask my question? You're talking about the updates on Gateway programming here, right? 645 slots. I think you skipped the updates on the Gibson facility. Would that be like the what's this?
Absolutely.
All these yellow markers and what you're doing out on Gibson and I see new stuff every time I come. So could you please go over that?
Thank sure. So the Gibson facility updates. Overall, we're talking about, when we're thinking about facility updates, we're talking about the construction that is happening, the new pieces that we're opening into. So that's the medical respite and medical sobering portion that I went over. Apart from that, like Errol said, we have our tenants who are housed here that are also operating with us within the facility. And we, with AMG, the update I have from the last day, one of our tenants here, we've added, they've added beds and they have more chronic care that is available on site. So overall, inside of the facility, that's everything that's happening with the addition of the 35 meal only beds that we're opening for the winter. So that is everything that is happening within the facility right now.
So your receiving area where you had the lockers, you've already talked to us, those who are new, about how people check their stuff in, their drugs and their stuff in the lockers when they come in. That's all done. And your respite area, is that all done? What other kind of construction are you doing on the second floor based on the tour that we were given back last December and walked through the building when it was still a shell? And then secondly, what about the building at the back of the property? That's building 11. What's happening with that?
Yes. So with the first piece that you mentioned, of course, receiving area and the lockers. The lockers, I'm assuming that you're referring to, are the lockers that we have at the entry
point. Oh, the trust something? Trust box?
Amnesty boxes.
I have an amnesty box. They might want to know about that. I found that very interesting.
Sure. Like I said, low barrier. And from my informed. Part of that model is that we have our clients coming in and they have our locker right at the front side of the doors that open up to entry. And they have a designated amnesty box where they're able to leave their belongings. We are not looking into the belongings. That is their personal stuff. And they are able to access that locker going back outside, coming back in, but what they leave there stays there. Of course, there are no weapons or drugs allowed inside of the facility. So when they come in, we make sure that they have checked in their belongings outside of the amnesty box is where they end up. Now, this is separate from the receiving area. This is our regular operations, ladies coming in, daily routines going in and out of the housing navigation facility. On the receiving area side, we talked about how first responders would drop off, and we are going to be triaging in that side of the Gibson Center.
They're not given an option of an amnesty box. It's a different receiving area.
They would have amnesty boxes available to them as well. Yes.
Oh, okay. Thank you. And so you're still working on construction on all the beds, and is that all complete?
So for medical respite and medical sobering, we're still working on construction. It's underway, and we're expected to go live, anticipated next year fall. There was a third part.
Yeah, so you have the winter beds already, because you already used those last winter.
Yes.
Okay. So there's a property in the back of the property, I think it was where Kadisha had her operation. I wonder if it's still operating, what you're doing with that building, because I understand it was closed.
Yes, you're spot on with identifying what building. That is building 11.
11, yes.
And that is what we're opening up for our winter beds. So these
oh,
are
that'll be your winter beds. Okay,
so
on the first floor.
On the first floor, winter beds. Yes, and on the second floor, Kadisha is still operating up there.
Oh, she is.
A resource center.
The resource center, the classes, the training. Yes.
Thank you. Because I think you skipped over that one.
Thank you for the reminder. Yes.
I just want to dovetail on that. And so outside of the building and the construction that's going on Gibson, does that have anything to do with the Hawk Light
yes.
that they're installing?
Would you like to chime in on that one? I'm not really
yes.
aware of that. Yes.
Agendas. Are there more agendas?
Thank you for
asking. Hawk Light, that that was part of the traffic study. That was part of the feedback and worry about pedestrian crossing. That is what that construction is. And I think that is estimated to be done here before the end of the year. But that is exactly what that is. And thank you for asking.
All right. We're comfortable in transitioning over to you, Debbie. Yes, go ahead. Yes, I'm going to pull it up.
Cool. Well, while she's pulling up my presentation, I can introduce myself. So I know I told you my name is Devin Mandel Kloster, the city of Albuquerque, and I oversee, so as right now I'm acting division manager for homeless programs and initiatives, but I kind of also wear the cap of a community outreach coordinator, and I kind of specialize in housing. So that is why I will be giving you a presentation on supportive housing programs. A little bit about my background, though, is I came from a direct service background. So I started in the schools doing dropout prevention, then worked in youth homelessness, so independent living for youth. And then before I came to the city, I worked in Las Cruces at Pensilla Valley Community of Hope. And I helped administer both the Linkages and then the HUD COC, so a permanent supportive housing program down there, for about 4 years. So I came to the city and tried the policy side and some oversight. So in my role, I oversee all of the grants that provide housing to homeless individuals and families that run through the city. So this is not only administrating funding, but also the policies and procedures, monitoring for compliance. Our team does all of that. So we are very heavily involved in supportive housing vouchers. Do you want to go to the next slide?
Let's do it.
We see an unmet need in our community. So I think you're seeing visible homelessness in our community of people on the street who are needing access to housing. So we have approximately, this number can be estimated higher, 2,200 unhoused households needing permanent supportive housing. So I'll go into the different types of supportive housing. There's about a few types that fall under two categories. And then we also have a need not only for the subsidy.
I was just wondering, how did you come up with that number?
So a lot of this is based off of accumulation of data for what you might have heard of called a PIT count, which is a point in time count of who is experiencing unsheltered homelessness. They also look at people who are experiencing sheltered homelessness, so those accessing the resources in our communities, the shelter resources. And then we also look at the coordinated entry data. So this is a system where people are trying to access housing or services, and they are doing an assessment. So they're saying, and it's called the vulnerability index. So it basically ranks how vulnerable that person is if they stayed on the street or a family. And it gives this number. It's not a perfect tool, but it will show us kind of what they're eligible for in our system. So this is a nationwide, our statewide system. We have a statewide survey, but nationwide, almost every municipality, I don't know of any city or place that does not have an assessment because it is HUD mandated. So it's kind of a mix of funding of types of.
I thought we had like 2,500 to 5,000.
So I think so to be clarifying too is permanent supportive housing. So there's a lot of people who might not qualify for a long-term permanent supportive housing, which I will get into in a little bit, but is good for clarity, is long-term assistance without a time limit. So this is like you're going to need ongoing assistance for the foreseeable future. There's some people who just need eviction prevention. They're experienced, they need a deposit, they need a few months of rent, or they need 2 years of rent, and then they can be sustaining on their own. And so we're saying there's approximately 5,000 people who are experiencing homelessness in our community, but permanent supportive housing vouchers or permanent units, we're estimating around 2,200. So those would be the highest need of people.
people. We also need, so this kind of gets into kind of our housing. I'm going to move forward on this because it's not my area of specialty, and I know we're back on time. But we do need affordable units. So I could put all the supportive housing vouchers out, and we could have tons of funding. But if I don't have a landlord that wants to rent to them, or they don't have a unit that falls into affordability, we're kind of in this moment where it takes a very long time to get somebody housed, especially if they have an eviction in their background or not great credit. Those can be really big barriers for getting people into programs.
And I'll just insert, when you hear the city, we're buying hotels, the hotel we purchased at Eubank and I-40 called SureStay, now it's called Los Altos Lofts. That's an example of affordable that's going to be respond. A police person could live there, a teacher could live there, or somebody coming off the street. It's a mix, but it's all considered affordable housing. And that will be about 90 units on the market starting early in the year.
So are they charged according to their income?
Yes, and you'll get to hear more about that based on the voucher. Yes, and then
I think go to the next slide.
Why do you have that picture up there? Is that part of the city?
Do you know which one this is?
That's Sawmill. That's down where.
No, I know exactly where it is. I was just wondering if you were indicating that was city housing.
Well, it's not city housing. City's been involved because of that land trust, and there are affordable units there. So part of our division and our department's very involved in that. And it's a mix of both affordable housing and market rate housing, which is always the best. We all don't know what our neighbors make. We don't want to clump. I mean, we just want the mix. And so Sawmill's a good example.
And it's a good creative use of land because it is a land trust where you own your house, but you don't own the land that it's on. So it makes it more affordable. You have it for a certain amount of time. You can actually sell the home. I mean, so it's there are a variety of ways to be more creative in creating housing. And the Sawmill is one of our kind of more exciting ways that we've done that in the city so far. And we also know that to reach any of these numbers, we are a partner in a bigger housing crisis and a bigger housing solution. So like this is a really creative solution in our community and the city is part of it, but
we're not all
we're
of
not all of it. We can never be all of it.
Do you know, I work a lot with Street Safe and As You Are, and that when we give vouchers out, they often come back and people won't accept their voucher.
I'm hoping we can get to my last slide, which is one of our. Yeah. No, I'm just very excited. It will be my second presentation on it today if I can get to it.
So we didn't do community guidelines at the beginning. We somehow skipped that, but I'm gonna sort of just real quick say that these are community guidelines. Like if you want to review them, but part of what I do is try to make sure that we're able to get through the agenda. So I'm going to ask you guys if you would, and if you need some paper, let me know and I can bring it to you. Take a note of your questions and let's try to let her get through, and then we can ask questions at the end. Would that be okay? Because I think you have a lot of slides. Yes, I seem to recall that. We really like that you're engaged.
And I'm hoping I get all your questions, but I'm really open to them afterwards. I could talk about housing vouchers. Talk about housing vouchers every day. I am very excited to hear more about your thoughts. And it also can be very confusing. So what is a housing voucher? What does it mean? What am I talking about? So when I'm talking about a supportive housing voucher, it is not just rental assistance. It is rental assistance, but it is also a case manager or a support team that is embedded with that partner. So there is someone supporting that household. So supportive housing vouchers are not Section 8. I want to make sure that's very clear. That's a housing subsidy, an important housing subsidy, but that doesn't come with any kind of support and or any kind of additional resource to help those families or that household gain independence or access resources in the community to build support systems naturally. So when you're given a voucher, a household will pay up to 30% of their income. So if they have Social Security, they will not exceed 30% of that Social Security to pay rent. And that is based, so there's calculations through HUD, and we have all the forms to kind of calculate that a family is not exceeding 30%, which is deemed affordable. Affordable is not exceeding that. And so if they have zero income, that agency is paying 100%. And if they have income, they pay. So it's really based on individual situation. This also includes utilities, deposits, some damages, and application fees. So we're really trying to make sure that the family, if they get a voucher, they're getting into a unit with some of those things covered until they can maybe stabilize on their own, or if not, some people will never be able to pay 100% of rent due to different situations. So where this is like a support for them. And then there's a number of types of vouchers. So you'll hear housing vouchers used to cover everything. There's HUD vouchers, that's a big funder in our community and generally. So that encompasses two types of HUD vouchers. And then it gets more confusing and I could go on. But that's basically Section 8 is also a HUD program, but that is not a supportive housing voucher, which is what we do in my department of the city. There's also city general funds. So our city council and our administration have allocated funding to provide housing for individuals in our community. So they function very similar to a HUD voucher, but we are paying for them. And then there's the Section 8 public housing. And then MFA and the VA also have supportive housing programs. They are not run through the city departments, but they do connect to a lot of the same partner agencies that we use. Also a note here is that the city itself, I do not provide any rental assistance to anyone. I am not their case manager, and we do not administer their direct funds to the landlord. We partner with nonprofits to provide those services and pay the rent. We then reimburse them when they ask us for it. Well, they reimburse every month to pay the rent, and they are doing providing the services so they can be tailored to different demographics and be a lot more responsive than the city could if I was paying rent. And then we serve homeless households generally, but that encompasses families, youth, and now we're expanding to medical respite. So people who we're going to add programs to support that medical respite that you'll be seeing here at Gibson Gateway. So our data also shows, so we're not just giving funding out, they're also reporting data back. So there's data systems called HMIS, which is the Homeless Information Management System, or Homeless Management Information System. And that will track who's in programs, who's in coordinated entry, track their income, their demographics. But we are also tracking every quarter for all of our partners. So we are seeing about 95% of these, so we administer 1,365 vouchers through our department, will maintain housing stability. So we're not seeing them re-enter homelessness, we're not seeing them get kicked out of programs, we're seeing high retention, which is really important. We don't want someone to have housing, lose housing. We want them to get integrated back into the community and have stability. And then they're referred through. So how do you get a housing voucher? Is it something I say, I know someone who needs one. A ways to access them is the coordinated entry system. And that's for homeless individuals or people who are experiencing homelessness. There's community agencies who administer that, and then the Coalition to End Homelessness is also a big point of contact. So they would get in touch with them and enter in through different points to say, hey, I need support. Can you access me in and help me resource? And then we also have case conferencing, which is where a lot of our partners come together and really try and troubleshoot who they're seeing. Are they seeing this person every day at the park? Or they're always there at their drop-in, but they don't know what's going on with them. And they're bringing in all the agencies to see what they can do to try and get that person to housing. You guys will have case conferencing. We see it at the Family Navigation Center. And then there's project-based referrals. So if we're given a program to medical respite, that fee doesn't need to go through an external place. They are the medical respite. And they're going to survey them to see if they're appropriate feed-in. So some of our project-based. So, catch my breath, sorry. One of the big types and one of the big needs we see in our community is a lot of people need permanent supportive housing. So the specific thing when you're looking at PSH is it's not time limited. They're not saying, hey, clock starts now, you gotta get an exit. This is for usually your higher needs population, so it's targeted to serve people who are chronically homeless. So a chronically homeless person is a disability and has been homeless for a year or more, or four times in the last 3 years, that equals a year. It's very HUD, it's very complicated, but it's those long-term people who have been homeless. We also have PSH programs that are for families. We have them for youth. We also have them for medical respite, and then victims of human trafficking. So we've allowed for a little bit more specialization than HUD can allow for and with our city-funded program, so we're able to serve some different populations that might not meet the criteria of being chronically homeless, which is what HUD serves with their permanent supportive housing. So again, most of our programs are funded by the HUD COC and City General Fund. Again, other PSHs in the community are going to be your MFA linkages program, and then additional HUD COCs that don't come through the city. They are just getting funding from HUD to a nonprofit in our community.
Does everybody know what COC is?
Oh, yes.
Chamber of Commerce?
I'm using lingo, I apologize. It's the continuum of care. So there are two continuums of care in New Mexico. There is Albuquerque, and there is the balance of state, which is everybody else. So we have a number of partners in our community that are part of this continuum of care. So this is group people who are providing services to those experiencing homelessness, and we are all brought together through our community partner, which is New Mexico Coalition, to have access to resources and bring people together to serve better in collaboration. But it also refers to the funding. It has so many meanings, and it gets a little complicated, but there's kind of the scope of services, and it's also a type of funding. And so our supportive services include case management, as it also a connection to social services outside of your case manager. We don't ever want a family to be dependent on one case manager or one person or one agency. We want to make sure that they have a breadth of different perspectives and different resources, so we're not just one stop. That case manager helps primarily with housing, with connection, but we also want to make sure that they're connected to UNM. They're connected to other job trainings. We want to make sure we're bringing everyone in, but that's where the supportive services come in, because they're also going to their home. They're inspecting it, like yearly. They are making sure that their income's being calculated. Are they increasing income? Do you have food? Like, those check-ins are what comes with supportive services. And then there's two types of permanent supportive housing. There's your scattered site, which means I have a voucher and I'm a provider, and I'm going to find a landlord who is willing to work with us. And that family or that individual is going to live in that apartment mixed into the community. So that's like we pay the rent to landlords in our community for that unit. Then there's also site-based. So when you're in scattered site, you hold the voucher. If you move, the voucher moves with you. If you're permanent supportive housing that's site-based, it's that unit is subsidized. And if you live in that unit, you get the subsidy. And if you move out, you don't have that subsidy anymore. One example is Hope Village. That is a site-based permanent supportive housing program. The other type of housing we see in our community is rapid rehousing. So many refer to this as the lightest touch of housing. Arguably, no, but that is kind of what you might hear. It has time limited. So you get into your unit and the clock does start ticking. And it's usually 12 to 24 months, maxing out at 24 months of support. So we have programs that serve, again, a criteria to go into our programs is that you're experiencing homelessness. But we also have some for families, for youth, and for victims of human trafficking. And so our programs, again, are funded by HUD, our City General Fund, and then we do have two additional types of funding, but they're both HUD. So they follow a lot of that same high-level criteria. And then they also get supportive services. So even if you're in the short-term program, you still get supportive services, someone coming in, and they're probably gonna really focus on building your income so that you can sustain your unit after the program ends. We don't want anyone to have support for 2 years and then we peace out and then that family is in crisis again. You really want to make sure that they're building their skills, they have some of that support, and they are planning for their independence. Whether that is getting into a different type of subsidy like Section 8, or it's getting a job and they were just in crisis and they hit some hard times and now they can sustain on their own afterwards. Again, there's two types of rapid rehousing, scattered site and site-based. So we wanted to kind of go into a little bit of like, okay, there's all these people on the street, why can't I pick this person and like put them in a house? And I understand the draw to want to do that. I think we also have to remember that housing, we are always operating in a scarcity. We don't have enough housing generally, but we specifically don't have enough supportive housing or funding or units for everybody. So there is a requirement to kind of prioritize different individuals or different scores to have them access housing. We just don't have enough housing for everybody, as we said in the unmet needs section. But one of our major fundings is this HUD that I'm talking about. So this comes with really strict rules. They have the interim rule for HUD is so long and so complicated, and so we know that these programs have a lot harder restrictions to get people in. So for a PSH, you have to be chronic. You have to be experiencing long-term homelessness and have a documented disability, and we need to document your homelessness for the last year, which if you're moving around, you're living precariously, very hard to document. But our teams at the coalition are, you know, diligently trying to reach out to people and document. And so that there's, we have 9 programs between PSH and Rapid Rehousing that are HUD funded, and they're pretty big programs. They all have to be referred to the coordinated and through the coordinated entry system. We can't skip and say, hey, we have John here. It has to go down the list, and we have to prove that we're going down the coordinated entry list to access housing to HUD. And then for Rapid Rehousing, you have to score in a range. We can't be putting someone who's chronically homeless in a program for 2 years. We're sending them up. And we have to really balance that right referral to the right type of program. And for HUD, that's based on score. And then HUD funds require a high level of administrative oversight and monitoring, documentation, and then there are limits to what they can and cannot cover. So we see a lot of limits to, they'll have even income, like rent limits. So we are seeing rents really skyrocket in our community. It's very hard for HUD to keep up. They are always like a year or two behind in affordability and how much your unit costs. 1 year, like 4 years ago, the cost went down. And I don't know anything that got cheaper 4 years ago, but HUD said units got cheaper. And so we have to kind of, we can do rent reasonableness, which is, again, way too in the weeds, but we have to show that it's a reasonably priced unit to HUD and not just to our community. And then I think I kind of went over the rest of this. And then the city general funds. So we have a majority of our programs are city general funded. So we generally model our programs off of a lot of HUD. They do a lot of best practice in terms of how they administer the grant. So it's very much protecting for fraud. It's protecting, making sure there's documentation. And we also don't want to say, hey, if you get a HUD program, you're out of luck, because these general fund programs do whatever. So we want to make sure there's alignment and some fidelity to the model of housing. So we follow most of the HUD regulations, but do allow for more flexibility. So we can say, hey, this program is for families, because we know our families need help. We can say that as a city general fund. Or we can say, hey, victims of human trafficking, we can prioritize you because we're not going through HUD's priority. So we've been able to kind of make more dynamic our housing. So investment in supportive housing, so these are the years, so FY18, sorry. We are spending about $6,800,000 in housing vouchers, and we are now spending $23 million. So we have really increased not only our number of vouchers we provide, but also,
And we should say, this is great for the taking pictures, and we'll make sure this is on the website too, but it's fine.
And
what
we,
is that current? Thank you.
23 million 500. So I think an important thing to show is that we not only have increased the amount of vouchers, we've also really prioritized permanent supportive housing vouchers, as that is the need we're seeing in our community. We were seeing that people, the 24 months was good, but we were seeing people with way higher need, with way higher barriers, who needed longer term support. So we really invested in that. That inherently will be a little bit more expensive. We also wanted to right-size case management. So it's important to get someone to a unit that we can subsidize for them, but we also want to make sure that case manager can see them as much as they need. So we really tried to right-size caseloads and the payment for those people providing those services. You're good. Cool, thanks. So some new initiatives with vouchers. So we also, so with that bigger spending, you're gonna say, what are we doing differently? What's the difference between all those years? We also have added 129 units of affordable housing at city-owned properties. So this is a rent subsidy that's, we're making, we made 129 units affordable that weren't affordable before, which is awesome. So those are unit subsidies. We also added more capacity for case collaboration, so for people in encampments. So we made sure that there was the people who could organize and the time for people to come together and case conference those hard to reach people in encampments to try and get them connected into resources and eventually housed. We also added more motel vouchers to support housing, so we know we're seeing long times to get into units. People might need a place indoors now. We added more motel funding because we know that there's some lacking in the time between getting from the streets or in shelter into housing, and so we wanted to make sure there was some coverage for that time. We also, which is really awesome because we added security deposit coverage for people who are entering Section 8 through the Albuquerque Housing Authority. There are some rules with, you know, you get someone in a program and they now need a $900 deposit to enter Section 8. And they could have long-term sustaining subsidy in Section 8, but those barriers were those security deposits, first month's rent, which HUD cannot cover. So the Section 8 voucher cannot cover deposits, cannot cover application fees, and so we provided some funding to make sure there was that way in to those Section 8 vouchers that exist.
Can you elaborate what a Section 8 is?
Yes, of course. So Section 8, also known as, if you get technical, it's like some people call it the housing choice voucher. So people in our community, I believe there is actually a 3,000 person waiting list to get into Section 8.
It's like public housing, public. Is what people call it.
And then public housing is often to a wait list, but it's a unit. Yes. So the public housing is you'll see those developments and those units will be subsidized and they can go in there and get the subsidy. Section 8 is basically the subsidy, like a permanent supportive housing voucher without the case management, that can subsidize for an extent with no time limit a household. So they can go in, that's through the housing authorities. So they are going to find a unit in the community and then lease up, and then they'll get the subsidy in that unit, much like we are, but there's no services.
I thought it was a way to get out of the dry house, but thank you.
No, a little different.
One day.
And then we kind of are committed to updating and improving our coordinated entry system. So we put in a coordinated entry system, HUD mandated it, and now we're just trying to look at it and see, hey, does this serve our community? Does this say what it needs to do? Does it track the right data? So we're evaluating that, which is great. And then we also provided furniture assistance. So we could get someone into a unit, but do they have a bed? Do they have pots and pans? And so we've really increased the funding and or access to those kind of services to make sure that they're home once they move in.
We're to wait for questions, right? Where does the furniture come from?
So we actually partner with Adelante or Give Albuquerque, and they are donation-based, but I believe they also purchase furniture in the community, and then they have this big, awesome warehouse where a family will come in or a household will come in with a voucher and say, hey, I have a unit, and they'll be like, there's a token or something, and they're like, you can get a couch and a table, and they'll set them up and help them get that to their home.
And many people in the community donate to Adelante, for example, and that's
it's like a big.
You can donate, and it's all new mattresses.
Yes. We cannot give out old mattresses through our program. And then the Gateway and Family Navigation Centers also are getting set aside vouchers, so we can make sure that there's the exits for these programs. This is the part I was really excited about telling you about. It is a new initiative that we are working on. So this is the Landlord Engagement Project. So we are working on it. Rolling it out in fall of 2024, which basically is we know that people need units, and we know that landlords are hesitant to rent to people with vouchers. This came out of that source of income where they said that vouchers are a verifiable source of income. They were going to do a study, and we were like, we're so excited about this, let's do a project creation. And so for the last 9 months, we've been meeting weekly with a consultant to create this program. And so basically, we are going to cover all permanent supportive housing vouchers through the city and through HUD to guarantee, basically give some landlords an incentive to rent to voucher holders and also some protections.
Just touch the screen. The screen is very smart.
Keep going.
the double cut. So everybody who receives it or is currently in or will receive a permanent supportive housing voucher, their landlord then gets access, and their household gets access to what is called a risk mitigation fund for many people. And it covers a variety of things that could happen while someone's in a tenancy. So it gives a little bit of financial security to those landlords renting and a little bit of leverage for the participant to be like, hey, you don't have to worry about me, even though they might know they're not going to damage their unit. This gives a little bit of an incentive. So it can cover up to $2,500 in damages above the security deposit. And then it also helps to get units up to HQS inspection, so $1,000 to make sure your unit will pass a HUD inspection, or a unit will repass a HUD inspection, which is really exciting.
What's HQS?
Housing Quality Standard Inspection. People are very worried about them, but I swear they're not that bad. We do them all the time. It's basically, does the stove work? Do the windows lock? Do the doors not drafty? Is there any fire hazards? Is the oven working?
Yeah.
We're basically checking a unit to make sure anyone would want to live there, and it meets basic safety standards and habitability standards. And then there's $500 in flex funds that can cover those things that are just hard to cover, so extensive cleaning, or a pet deposit, or a little bit of rent. So if someone falls behind on rent, we can cover up to 1 month in rent. So we're really proud of the variety that we get to cover for people to give a little bit of an incentive. And then the 1 month of vacancy loss. He does not like this part, and I was so excited. So this will also include, so there's these coverages. We're going to be able to cover landlords and tenants to help them stay in their units, to maintenance. So if someone breaks out their window, they don't have to live with a broken window because they don't have the funds to cover it. They can pull it out of this fund, and they don't have to put their housing in jeopardy or their safety.
And all of this is hugely important with people with behavior health, serious mental illness, things like that, which are the people usually going into permanent supportive housing.
Yes.
Just to clarify.
And then it also comes with landlord liaisons, which my layman's term says this is a case manager for landlords. So if there's a landlord in the community who wants to work with vouchers, or we think could work with vouchers, they have affordable units, or a landlord who has them and just has concerns, there's somebody to reach out to. There is a landlord liaison who could be the middle person between the case manager and the landlord, or the tenant and the landlord, for in these situations to help mitigate any concerns. So they can hear out the landlord by being a neutral party. And so we're going to embed 3 landlord liaisons to serve Albuquerque. We just finished our RFQ, so we'll be awarding that to a nonprofit here soon. We want to make sure it was somebody who's doing the work and knows the landlords and knows the people. And then they'll be providing those services and helping process any of these claims that could come in. And then we will be working with MFA to pay out the claims. So,
and that's the Mortgage
Finance Authority.
It's a state agency.
So they will be able to pay those landlords. They have a turnaround time of about 3 days. So from time of the claim coming in to time of the claim being reviewed and then paid out is about 3 days. So they're collecting data on what happened, how much money, and all these different data so we can better serve our tenants and our landlords. And so it's really exciting because this is something that's happening across the country, but it doesn't always happen for the population that we're getting to serve, so it's very nuanced, and it's very exciting to allow this in such a robust package for our tenants. Okay, I might have talked too much. But I know, are you allowed to have questions?
Yeah, it's 7:52, so we don't have a ton of time, but we can put some things off for the next meeting so you can ask questions.
So I'm working with the New Mexico Black Leadership Council on community mentoring, and one of our hopes is to engage families in the International District before, as they're being kicked out, are threatened to be kicked out before they live on the street. We don't want somebody having to live on the street a year to access all this, especially families with children. So of all that you've shared with us, as we encounter someone who is being kicked out because somebody bought the apartment complex and raised the rent 50% and they can't pay it, is there anything for someone? Do they have to go live on the street for a year in shelters? Is there anything for these folks to keep them from becoming homeless?
And that's very important. You're really targeting an area that we want to look at and expand within our community.